whiteboard, I think you probably figured we weren't in Kansas anymore. And that's true. I do not think that Cicero has to be a dull, boring subject. In fact, if you read Cicero now, I hope when you start opening him, you start seeing a man that God gifted, and God gave truth to that guy. Truth be told, I would rather read Cicero than a number of the modern day theologians that are out there. He causes me to pause and to think, more so than many other authors of this era. Is there anybody that would say amen to that? I hope so. I hope that this is not just me just babbling for a little while. And I've intentionally inserted one of my students from Westminster at a point. She's going to come and she's going to recite some of the Catilinarian oration in Latin. She actually recited 30 lines from line 74 to 104 perfectly without one single mistake. No pressure, Miss Hall. But she did that, and today she's going to do about 11. I only asked her this week. Isn't that the way we normally do it? Wait till the last minute, get a great idea, and then put somebody on the spot. That's what I did. But Keith graciously said she would come and do that. But what I would like to do is talk a little bit about Cicero's life, then talk about Latin a little bit, and then talk about some of the different ways that we can approach Cicero in the classroom, not necessarily from a Latin approach. This could be done in English just as easy. Is what we're going to talk about today. I just think that in Latin 3, that's the perfect year to do Cicero. And typically, even in the Jenny series and a lot of the schools around the country, we normally use a basic approach in 1, we go to Caesar in 2, we go to Cicero in 3, and the Aeneid in 4. Right? Isn't that sort of no imagination there, but that tends to be what we do. So we're actually going to do the same thing at Westminster. No imagination, right? We're going to be doing Cicero in 3 and the Aeneid in 4 as well. But I'm hoping that we'll do it with a little bit of a twist. As we're going along, I would love for you to jump in. I am a teacher. And so if you have something to add, I would love for you to say that. So don't feel like you've got to sit there. I want this to be interactive. I am not very good at just lecturing for 50 minutes. But that's just not who I am. Keith can tell you, I love feedback, constant feedback, and just interjection from people that are listening, because I imagine that there are people in here that have read just as much or more Cicero as I have. I'm sure there are. And so I don't say that I'm an expert on anything. I do love the guy. And I bemoan the fact that he's not going to be in heaven. I'm serious. I do think he had an understanding of things divine. I think he had an understanding of truth. But he did not know the gospel, obviously, but he didn't know Jehovah. And so, because of that, we won't see him there. But we do know that there will be people there because of him. Who's his most famous convert? Augustine. And so there were streams of people that'll come as a result of Cicero's writings. That, it gives me great pleasure to say that. So let's just talk about him a little bit. Now, I hate to tell you this, but my notes are not going to go specifically by the outline in the notebook. They'll come close, but not quite. I heard Mike McKenna yesterday talking about, if any of you were in the effective administrator session yesterday, what a brilliant, godly approach to being head of school or an administrator that Mike gave yesterday. If you didn't hear it, I would urge you to buy the tape, the CD, and listen to it. Just great. But he gave a little bit of a brief story, and I'm just going to tell you the story because I think it applies. He said that at the end of the year, there at their school at Rockbridge, they have a roast for the faculty. Anybody from Rockbridge here? Great. And so he told me some of the things that y'all do to him every year. I was hoping nobody from Westminster Academy was in that session. But it was quite good. And he started talking about all these different things that they did. But one year, he looked up on the screen. They had some video that was there. And he was up there in his wedding video dancing to... Do you remember the song? I can't remember. It's something like one of maybe Huey Lewis in the News. hip to be cool or something. I don't know what it is. One of those songs, you know, that we all want to forget because it was so long ago. And Cicero actually has something to say to that. Anybody know what it is? A wise man never dances. There are some jewels through the years that have been attributed to him, and I actually think that that's one of them. I've used that line on a number of occasions. But a wise man never dances. Let's talk about his life a little bit. Born about 106 B.C. in a little town called Arpinum. The Roman government had protected them at certain points. So there was an allegiance that was there in Cicero growing up. He was growing up under really the domain of the Roman government, the Republic during that time. Although there was no specific affiliation there yet, there would eventually become one. So Cicero was he lived there. His family had no lineage as far as senatorial power or anything like that. That automatically put him on the outs as far as Rome went. But his dad, and I love this about his dad decided that his sons needed an education. He decided that. That's something that today, one thing that we really love at Westminster is that dads be involved in the education of the kids, not just moms. It's sort of a given that moms are going to be involved. So, and I could go off on that, but this is about Cicero. But Cicero's dad took an active interest in his boy and began to make sure that he had the right kind of education. His nomen was Tullius, which was the name of Rome's sixth king, and I found that real interesting that that was the case. We all know, I think probably, that the name Cicero means chickpea, which he sort of had to deal with all through his life in different ways. It was thought, I found this note in one of the biographies, it was thought that some ancestor had a wart of the shape of a chickpea on the end of his nose, thus the name. How would you like that as the reason that you were named something, a wart? But anyway, his family there in Arpinum was that pretty much, you know, they were sort of wealthy in Arpinum. But when you compare that to what was going on in the Republic, they really had nothing. So he's going to school, and during that time, we know that children of the day learned the names of the letters even before they learned the shapes. That's interesting, isn't it? They sung them forward, they sung them backwards. They eventually began to add syllables to that into words. Imitation, repetition were used. At about 12, he graduates, he goes to another school, and the two subjects that he studied were grammar and literature. That's interesting as well. Latin and Greek were both taught. And so the emphases then were on Homer and really Euripides. And it tended to be more Greek than it did Roman, for obvious reasons. The best schools would offer rhetoric. And it was during this time that Cicero began to be exposed to a Greek history of rhetoric. And it began to just sort of go into his soul. Little by little, he began to study this. And one of the most important things that I think that we sort of lost one of the canons of rhetoric in Memoria. We tended to back up from that in our schools. And I don't know there in your school what you do. But if you think about what was going on in the Republic and really what was going on in Greece, speeches there could last for hours. Have you read some of those by some of the Greek orators? They just seem to, they go on and on and on. I love that. I can't imagine that going on today. But Cicero would sit at the feet of some of the greatest orators in Rome eventually when he gets to Rome, and he would sit in the forum and listen. As they would stand there on the rostra, he would sit and listen to them for hours, just taking in all the rhetorical devices. Now, at Westminster, one of the things that I want us to do in rhetoric, and I've been sort of trying to push our rhetoric teachers there, is to make our kids, when they're doing their sophomore, junior, senior theses, is that most of it be memorized by the senior year, if not all of it. Then that could be 20 to 25 pages. I think we sell our kids short when we say that they can't do that. I think they can do that. This young lady right here memorized 30 lines of Latin and made not one mistake. Incredible to me that she did that. Incredible to me. I'd hate to brag on you. I know that embarrasses Keith. I'm sorry. During this time as well, as Cicero was growing, and he was in the 12 to 14 range, he was studying fables and learning how to put those into his own words. He was learning how to turn those stories around and make them exciting. That's a fascinating thing to me. By the time he gets about 16, he takes on the toga virilis, the toga of manhood. And so it was a phase of his life that changed. Cicero's father finds him an orator in Rome, and he begins to basically become a client of this man. And he stays with him, and he listens to him, and the guy tutors him. The fellow has assignments for him. But he goes to the forum and begins listening to court cases. And it's something that he begins to develop a seriousness to the point where he wants to start writing even at an early age. And while all these other kids were out doing things that they wanted to do, he would still be sitting in the forum, or he would begin to write. He probably wrote some of the works that, like even Adorinium. Some people say that he may have written that pretty early in his career. Besides it being a sort of a plagiarism on rhetoric by Aristotle, and if you've read it, you can see that. I can tell you that students sometimes tend to read Cicero's version of it a little bit more quickly than they do Aristotle's version. I don't know if you've noticed that or not, if your school uses both those works. Adorinium flows very easily, and you can tell as you study, if you study Cicero's Latin or even the English version, you can see that the language development of him at Adorinium, and in the language development of him by the time he reaches to Mark Antony's the Philippics, if you've read those, totally different style of writing. Anybody read both? Who's read Adorinium in here? Has anyone read some of it? What about the Philippics? Even the second speech? If you do that, let me say, how many of you teach Latin here? Okay. What about teach rhetoric? Okay. How many of you have studied Cicero much? I'm just trying to check my audience. I probably should have done that at the very first. I think he's classroom worthy for the reasons that we're talking about. I think he fits a classical model of education perfectly. I think we can use him as an example of the development of virtue and wisdom in a person, and it coming through the modeling of men and I would also say women that are teaching. Now, I also think that, and I'm sort of jumping ahead a little bit, but I also think that what we're going to see is, as he gets older, some of his virtue, some of his wisdom that was developed in those early years of his life when he assumed the consulship, something happened to him. And we'll get to that when we talk about the Catilinarian conspiracy. Okay, well, I need to move on. He actually served in the military in roughly 90, and I'm just going to say 90 instead of saying 90 BC. I'm just going to say a date. We all know it's BC. He hated it. He was no soldier. He was no soldier. And, you know, I'm with him on that. And it's not that I hate war. It's just that I'm not a soldier. I'm just not. I so value what our military does, but it's something that I just know me. I would have to be a chaplain is what I would have to be. He decided after about a year to pull out. During this time, for the next 10 years or so, let's just say, the Roman Republic was going through a drastic civil war that just ripped them up big time. Marius and Sulla during this time did some awful things. About 80, he was 26, and he argues his first case. It was in defense of a guy named Roscius. Now, what is interesting about this, and I could spend hours looking at it, was that Roscius was accused of murdering someone that was a friend of Sulla. Now, Sulla was the one who started what was called the proscription lists. And if you're not familiar with that, I'll just take a brief aside. It was real common in the Roman Republic. And the very things that we value about the things in Rome, there are just as many things that we've got to say, whoa, wait a minute. It was a murder list, is what it was. If you didn't want somebody living, if you had a political enemy, you could put their name on that list and they could be hunted down and killed. Legally. So, Roscius was accused of murder. He didn't actually murder the guy. And this is Cicero's first case. That's a tough one. Why he chose to take it, I don't know. But I think he figured if he could make a big, really a grand entrance, which is, if you've studied him at all, one thing that you can never get past is what? His ego. And of course, that was part of Rome. That was part of that Roman persona, right? That was just all about personal glory. Because if I get personal glory, I can also help the Republic get glory. So Cicero winds up taking this case, and he winds up winning. But normally what would happen, and I've got a real long thing here that I could have talked about, I'm going to skip it though. He winds up winning the case. But if he had lost, if Roscius had lost, he would have lost his life. Cicero's career would have been over at that point. He never would have been able to rebound just because of the connection with Sulla. What is interesting in there as well is that Sulla could have, as a way, wound up having Cicero killed. But he didn't. He left him alone. I don't know why. About 79 B.C., right at the moment where he could have gone to Rome and just said, here I am, this is me, look at me, look at me, he decided that he needed to take some time off. A lot of people argue, if you studied his life, a lot of people argue that he was afraid of Sulla, and so he left to go to Greece to spend a couple of years there. Some people say his health was bad. My personal opinion is he wanted to study a little bit more rhetoric because he realized his skills were not quite what they needed to be. So he goes for 2 years. He goes to Greece, and then he comes back to Rome. And he wants to come back to Rome, and the thing that continues to haunt him is, Cicero believed that the Republic was dying. I really believe Cicero sensed the Republic was dying. And his goal when he came back to Rome in 78 or 77 B.C. was to restore the Republic. That was his goal. What a worthy goal that was. Honorable. So he starts going through what's called the cursus honorum. Just the office schedule, if you will. And you had to start low and you just sort of worked your way up to the consulship. You had to be a certain age at points to hold certain offices. So he comes back and that's what he does. He wins the office of quaestor in 75 B.C. No political power. None whatsoever. He basically would collect taxes. He would make payments. But this helped him get a reputation of integrity because he didn't try to rip people off, which was so common then and continued to be common even obviously during the time of Christ when tax collectors, as we know from Scripture and other places, they were just ripping folks off. Cicero had integrity. Well, the people loved him there. But when he came back, what was interesting was people would say, oh, you're back from Carthage. Oh, you're back from Greece. Oh, you're back from, as a way to mock him that he was in Sicily. And what he realized there was that the Roman people, they were deaf, but they had good eyesight. So he determined that one way for him to be successful was to be seen. So he made it his goal to be seen every day talking to people so that when people saw him, they wouldn't just know about an orator, but they would see his presence. And you know what? I think that really wound up being sort of the beginning of his descent as far as his ego went. Because anybody who thinks that they have to be seen to make a point, the message is all about them, isn't it? And I think that wound up hurting him in the long run. 71 B.C., he prosecutes a guy named Verres. Huge case. In fact, it is the case that winds up, I think, catapulting him to be able to win the consulship a little bit later. In Rome, the way that you made a name for yourself was by beating people in court cases. And at the time, there was a lawyer named Hortensius. You may have heard of him in history. The lawyer. The greatest advocate Rome had ever had. Until Cicero. So he actually winds up prosecuting Verres. And to just a... I hate to not tell you the whole story. But I can't. I don't have time. You got to read it, though. The speech is there. It's in the Loeb series. You just got to read it, though. Brilliant speech. Now, we obviously know that Cicero probably edited most of the speeches to make it really look like he was the smartest man in the world. So you have to be careful anytime you read any of his speeches, because he probably edited them to the point where he looked like just this master of the universe kind of guy. But he did win the case. 66 B.C., he wins an office called Praetor. And that held a little power. At this point, he's in the Senate. But nobody cared about that office, because everybody who was running for office eventually wanted to be one of the two consuls that was elected every year. That's all he wanted. So his eyes continued to be there. 65 B.C., his second and his last child was born. I've even skipped talking about his wife and his first daughter. He finally was able to run for consul in 64 B.C. Running against him were some people, just a hodgepodge of folks and he even called them basically a dullard and an imbecile and two other folks. I mean, he really did some ad hominem there, as he was prone to do at times. So he winds up winning the consulship. And this other guy wins it. But what's vital here is that there's one particular guy named Catiline that runs and loses. Now, I could go backwards a little bit and talk to you about Catiline, and I need to. What time are we over? 10:20? Is that right? Okay. Just tell you a brief little snippet about Catiline. If you think young people don't like Roman history, they've never read this story about the Catilinarian conspiracy. It's got everything that you could want it. It's got swords and murder. It's got a little bit of Catiline's nature in there. He was probably a little promiscuous. It gives you opportunities to talk about the parts of Roman culture that we would reject as followers of Christ. In his background, Catiline's background was me, and Catiline saw any political office was a way to get money. It was all about money. Because it would cost you money to run for office, but once you won it, then you could bilk the people out of all of their money and restore your wealth along the way to run for consul. What a wretched system. But that's what it was. But this Catilinarian conspiracy has got conspiracy in it, for heaven's sake. It's got the idea of overthrowing the government. So, it's got everything in it that kids would possibly want to read about. And then when you mix in the Latin element, I had a young man this year taking my class. Last year, I would have to say that with this student, I would not have said he was going to wind up being probably my most promising Latin student. I'll just say it that gently. This year, his mother came to me and she said, "Mike, would you tell Will to go to bed and to quit translating Catilinarian oration? He's staying up till 12:30 and 1 o'clock doing this. And we'll wake up and his light will be on and he'll be in there doing that." Something happened to that kid at some point, and he got excited about Latin and excited about history in a way that I could not have done that. Something clicked in him, and that happened. And I can tell you that, and Keith could say this as well, that our class, I would give them the option at times of translating the Vulgate or Cicero. And you know what they wanted to do? They wanted to do Cicero. Now, we did the Vulgate as well, by the way. Because I was wanting to preach through Titus in Latin, so I got to do that. But it was just fascinating to me that they would want to do that. Catiline, anyway, sorry for that aside. Catiline's a little bit older than Cicero. In many of the pictures, I've got this picture that is in a lot of the Latin books. In fact, the one book about the Catilinarian oration, this one is the one that Balchazzi has put out. It's a good text. It's a good text. It's got a lot of good notes at the bottom and everything. But this picture that they have, and I'll pass this around, and I meant to bring, I've got a portrait of this in my office, is totally wrong. It's absolutely wrong. Everything about it is wrong. So, but it shows in here Cicero is this stately, probably 50, 55-year-old, maybe even 60-year-old man. And it shows Caline sitting to the side here as a younger, probably in his 30s guy. And yet we know that Catiline was born before Cicero. How old? I don't know. The estimates are anywhere from 4 to 6 years difference. So a lot of things are incorrect in the painting, but it's still pretty. I still like it, even though it's historically inaccurate. Never mind. I don't have time to tell you that yet. I'm just going to keep moving. Anyway, Catiline was born. He was from a patrician family. He had a bunch of money. He could do what he wanted to. He wound up going to Carthage, being accused of extortion there, had to stand trial. It kept him from running for consul in 65 for 64 BC elections. Couldn't do that. He was ticked off about that. He was really irritated. Cost him a lot of money to basically bribe the jury to win his extortion case. So he started losing some of his backing and character in the Senate, and the patricians just started backing away from him. So he started trying to earn some support from the down and outers. He found guys, young men, that wanted women, money, weapons, and power. And started saying to them, "Man, aren't you in debt? How would you like it if you weren't in debt anymore? How would you like it if I got you whatever you wanted from a pleasure perspective? Would you like that?" He preyed on them to the point where he started getting all these down and outers all around Rome to try to support him. They started having secret meetings in houses. There was a camp that was set up for a piece of an army run by one of his allies, one of his colleagues. In an area called Etruria, which is sort of northeast, depending on what map you look at. And so they're gathering there. And so all this is building, and we're actually getting close to having Keith say her piece here. Some people say that there were actually two Catilinarian conspiracies, and the historians, maybe you've read voluminous writings about whether there was just one or two of them. I don't go into all that with my students. But one of them said the first time that he lost and couldn't run for the elections, he decided that they were going to descend on the Senate and kill them all. And somebody didn't give the right signal, and the whole thing was called off. Doesn't sound like much of a conspiracy to me, but they do call it, and I'm summarizing. And so this next one was a little bit more involved. I mean, it was very detailed, very planned. The problem was, there was this one young lady who was a girlfriend of one of the down and outers who was attending all the secret meetings. And when she would leave these meetings, she would go directly to Cicero and tell him everything that was going on. The whole plan. Her name's Fulvia. And I'll tell you what I do as a lure with kids, and Keith can tell you I did this. I would start telling them the story. We've been using Wheelock, and so in Wheelock they give you snippets of the Catilinarian oration. And I think chapter 12 is the first one. And so I'll start telling them a little bit of the story, and they'll say, what happened next? And you got to wait till Latin 3. And I don't talk about it. I just don't. I let them think about it and start, and they ask me questions. Well, you know, we don't have time for that right now. And I know that's not a good answer when a kid asks a question, but my purpose is to keep them asking questions and keep thinking. So what some students do is they go home and start looking it up. I'm the winner in that game all the time. So finally we get to Latin, and I'll start talking about this woman. It was this girl that got called up. Well, what was her name? I can't remember what her name was. So they start. I had students try to find her name, found out her name was Fulvia, and said, can you tell us any more about Fulvia? Well, if you've ever tried to find anything out about Fulvia, guess what? There's just very little in there about Fulvia. You can barely find anything about her. But she's a strategic cog in the whole deal, because she would go and tell Cicero everything. He gave about 4 speeches during this time. I'm not going to go into each one of them because I want to make sure I have time for... Well, you know, we don't have time for that right now. And I know that's not a good answer when a kid asks a question, but my purpose is to keep them asking questions and keep thinking. So what some students do is they go home and start looking it up. I'm the winner in that game all the time. So finally we get to Latin, and I'll start talking about this woman. It was this girl that got called up. Well, what was her name? I can't remember what her name was. So they start. I had students try to find her name, found out her name was Fulvia, and said, can you tell us any more about Fulvia? Well, if you've ever tried to find anything out about Fulvia, guess what? There's just very little in there about Fulvia. You can barely find anything about her. But she's a strategic cog in the whole deal, because she would go and tell Cicero everything. He gave about 4 speeches during this time. I'm not going to go into each one of them because I want to make sure I have time for Keith to recite. But he gives 4 speeches. The first one he gives, he has 0 evidence. I'm thinking that he's been thinking about this speech for some time, maybe as much as a month. And he's already memorized it. And then when he comes to the Senate chamber that night, he's gotten word that some of the stuff was already going on. So he changes the meeting place from the Curia, the Senate chamber, to the Temple of Jupiter, and surrounds it with guards. And while he's in there just chatting and talking, guess who walks in? Catiline. Something in me just feels like that Cicero had thought about Catiline coming, but I just think that the way that the speech is written, it's so direct, and every now and then he takes an aside and he uses the second person there. I don't think that he was anticipating Catiline coming. But then when he does come, he starts calling him sewage and a bunch of other words that kids will love, by the way. They just love it. My students just eat this stuff up. Well, the speech is so... If you've not read it, I printed a copy. It's in your packet. I printed an English copy of it off the internet, and I put the internet site there. You know, students can go there, but you know, if you're a Latin teacher, you know when a student hadn't translated something. You know that. I mean, it's, you can tell when somebody's trying to just cut and paste or whatever it is, right? Copy and paste, whatever it is. You know that. But I gave that to you. But as you read it, you hear Cicero making all these allegations, but how much proof does he have? None. He doesn't have a shred of evidence at this point. All he has is hearsay. Even if he brought Fulvia into the Senate, that wouldn't be considered evidence as a presentation. So he's just trying to just drum up something to the point where Catiline will get out of here. He tells him about 50 times, you're going to leave, so why don't you just go ahead and do it? But he doesn't say it like that. He says it 50 different ways. So eventually at the end of the speech, he does leave. Then he gives 3 more orations, and I summarize them there. I was tempted not to tell you what happened, hoping that you would go find out what happened. Because all the students want to know what happens to Catiline. And I tend to not tell them right off the bat. And what they normally do is they go home, they get on the internet, and they start looking up the story, and they find out for themselves. Then we can start having a dialogue rather than me just sort of trying to baby food them along to get them to that point. Because at some point, we all know that if a student gets turned on to what you're doing, they'll teach themselves. Right? And that's what our passion is, to see the light come on in a student and to get excited about the subject, and then they wind up teaching, and sometimes we just have to say, whoa, slow down a little bit. Let's stay within these parameters, and you'll be okay. Let's not go there. Let's come here. And most of the time, that's what we have to do. And I wish we had a class full of those kids, but we tend to not, right? Because you'll have a student like Keith who is just brilliant in the classroom. And then you have some other students who like Latin and are okay, but they're not going to do any more than that. And so it's a struggle at times in any class, whether it's Latin or anything else, to motivate the students properly. I'm going to jump down a little bit further. On the last day of Cicero's consulship, in any consul, the last day of their consulship, they were supposed to give an address to the Roman people. And as Cicero rises to stand up, one of the tribunes stands and says, he can't do this. Now, Cicero had probably been dreaming about this day as much as he had been dreaming about being a consul. But the tribune said, because he put Roman citizens to death without a trial, he doesn't deserve the right to do that. So he doesn't. He doesn't get to speak. He winds up a little bit later, and I'm going to really summarize. He winds up later being banished to Greece by Claudius, one of the consuls that had something against Cicero. Cicero had beaten him in some trials. Claudius basically sends him away because of him putting Roman citizens to death without a trial. Eventually, Pompey brings him back with a lot of glory. You know, just he winds up coming back to the Republic, and everybody's excited that Cicero returns and all this. And really, for the next probably 10, 12 years of his life, he sort of backs up and he starts to become a little bit more reflective. He really feels like that maybe his political aspirations and his political oratory, they're probably not going to last. And yet, what historians tell us now is that his political oratory is much more important than his philosophy. And that's the very thing that he started really emphasizing later in his life. I'm not even going to talk about the triumvirates or anything like that, and he had real issues with both those things. But when his daughter dies, he is just really affected by this. He's just so detached. But I will tell you, if you ever read The Nature of the Gods, tremendous book. His book about law, De Legibus, phenomenal resource. I don't have time to really do all that, so I'm just going to move on. Finally, we come down to where we've got this war going on again between Pompey and Caesar. And Cicero winds up supporting Pompey. That ultimately will cost him his life. Ultimately. This is about 50 or so. But eventually that's going to cause him his life. Because as he goes on down, eventually we know Caesar's assassinated. And they had asked Cicero to at least support it, supposedly. And he apparently backed up and said no, and guess who takes over? Mark Antony. And Cicero's been concerned about the Republic the whole time. He's been concerned because he does not restore the Republic. I think the Republic started getting a serious case of cancer in 100, my own opinion. And it was dying by that time. And by the time he became consul, it was over. The Senate had so much power, and then when these strong leaders would come in, they would take the power away. So it wasn't truly a republic in that sense of the word. It was an aristocracy for the most part. And then it became, as we know, a dictatorship at different points. And I think Cicero grieved over this. So eventually, guess who gets put on a revived proscription list? Cicero does. Mark Antony gets him put on this list. Stories vary about how he died. Some people say he was racing to one of his villas and he had slaves around him and they fought him off and all this. Some people say Cicero said, don't do that. Some people say he had his head out of his cart and it chopped his head off. All the accounts say that they chopped his head off and cut his hands off and they were nailed to the rostra. All the accounts say that. But how it actually happened, I don't know, but the guy's dead. Okay? He's dead. We know that. We know that for sure. What we have is a legacy of writing. Now, as far as some of the things that he's written, I was just going to call out a couple of things that you might want to use if you're teaching rhetoric. If you're not using a text, Cicero actually wrote a number of works on rhetoric. He wrote Ad Herennium, De Invenione. He wrote a book called Topica, if you've not ever read that. Great summation of the common topics. Probably one of the more famous works that he wrote is De Oratore, which is a great, great book. You have trouble finding it. It's actually like split in two low volumes, and the first volume of De Oratore is a little hard to find, although Inklings had one. You heard the pluperfect there. Had. I've got it now. He has another one called Brutus that's good, and then he has another one just called The Orator. His political speeches, I brought one of the lobes. It's got the four Catilinarian orations in it. I'm trying to basically get everything the guy wrote, but that's a good one. He's got a ten volumes in the Loeb series of his political speeches. From a philosophical perspective, the De Natura Deorum is a great book. De Finibus is one that I really like as well. I think what you're hearing me say is anything Cicero writes is worthy of our attention, in my opinion. If you're looking for a Roman author that touches really all of life, he's your guy. He's your guy. I would encourage you to do that. And then he's got letters to Atticus, just some letters that he's written. We should use him because he gives his life gives us historical insight into the Republic. That's a reason we ought to study Cicero's life. It's because we can learn about the Roman Republic and even the Roman model of education studying him. And why would we not choose somebody to focus on when we're studying the Republic proper? I think you should do that. His career also gives us this idea of the classical mind. You can see him develop, if we narrow the idea of classical education to the trivium, I would say that you can see Cicero's life develop according to the trivium. Perfectly. And by the time he's older, he's writing philosophy, which is interesting. But he also, his life in language gives us the opportunity to integrate history and rhetoric and logic and Latin as well. Now, what are we doing at Westminster Academy? In the third year of Latin, we tend to finish up a piece of Wheelock, the last little piece of Wheelock, and then we jump right into the Catilinarian Oration and start translating it. Through the process, I'm giving a pretty intensive Roman history segment as well. Now, one thing that we did on Thursdays this year was we translated through Titus in Latin. And I spent a couple of months in Titus 1 talking about elders and the character of elders. Because I think our kids need to hear about what God calls, really, people to be. But there's just something significant about elders in their character as well. Somebody who shoots at nothing, hits it every time. And so this idea of character development was good. And so then I was able to talk about the character of an elder and Cicero's character as well. Because there were moments when Cicero showed that great character, and then there were moments where he allowed the power of the consulship to absolutely blind him to what was good and what was right about the Roman Republic. So we do that. And then, this is one of the things that we did with the Catilinarian Oration as well. We did not do this year. I normally give the students an opportunity to do something like that if they have completed their, if they've completed the speech or they're real close to it, and we have some days where we can do something like that. And you can see that I let them sort of exercise their imaginations a little bit. One group that, the other group that, I broke them down into two groups. One group did this PlayStation 2 game. The other one did a National Enquirer in Latin. And it was hilarious. But they didn't laminate it for me, so I don't have it. And it's got a picture of Fulvia on the front just making this weird face, like, oh my, you know, something like that. But it's just great. And then I'm gonna tell you what we did at the end of the year, then I'm gonna let Keith recite her lines. Basically, my class said they wanted to, I wanted them to memorize some Latin. And so the Catilinarian Oration just popped up. And so we started assigning lines, and different kids picked different lines. And they had to recite it in front of the class, and they had to do it with passion. They couldn't just, blah, 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 blah. You know, I wanted it to be an exercise in memory. I wanted it also for them to develop the ability to speak in front of other people. And they're freshmen. Basically, these are ninth graders who did this. And so then I had this real odd twist. I invited my Latin 3 class to my house. Now, school is out at this point. We've had our final assembly. It's real formal and everything. It's a great way to end the year. But right afterwards, they come over to my house. That's when most of them did their recitation at my house. Hey, I have to do it, actually. School was over. I'd already even turned in the grades. But this was the deal. If they came to my house, they had to recite it on the diving board. And if they made a mistake, they got pummeled with water balloons. If they made 5 mistakes. And so, that's odd, I grant you. Really odd. It's just really, really odd. But, you know, guys, why do we have to use the same formal methods with kids? Now, when I'm in the classroom, it's a classroom and we do all, but this was just played a little bit deeper in the curriculum because his Latin is a little more intense. Now, I'd like for Keith to come and she's going to recite lines 74 to 85. Is that right? 74 to 85. And she's going to stand at the mic. I did bring some resources if you want to look at them. I can talk to you about some authors on his life if you'd like, but there's a book that's very good that's been out here a couple of years. Go ahead, Keith.
Recognosce tandem mecum noctem elam superiorem. I am intelligens multo me vigilare authoris, a salutum quam te ad perniciam rei publicae. Dico te priore nocte, Minisi inter falcarios, non agam obscure, in im like domum. Can minisi eodim, can fleris eosim, amitiae scelerisque socios. Num negadere ad deis, quid taces, con vigam si negas. Video enum esse hic insanatu coetum. Quostam qui tecum unas loret. O di immortales, ubinam gentium sumus, quam rem publicam habemus, in qua urbe vivimus, hic sunt in nostro numero, patres conscripti, in hoc orbis terrae sanctissimo gravissimoque concilio, quide nostro omnium interitu, quide fugius urbis atque adeo de orbis terrarum exidio cogitent. Hos ego video consul, ede republica sententiam rogo, et quos ferro tributare et portabat, eos nondum voce vulnero.
I just love to hear kids do that. I just love to hear kids do that. And I think we sell them short when we think they can't do things like that. And by the way, she had memorized 30 lines. And if we'd have done this a month ago, she could have 30 right in a row. But this was, I think I asked you on Wednesday or something like that. So thank you for doing that. I appreciate it. Now really, I'm through. I appreciate you coming. There were a number of great sessions that were available during this time. And to hear me talk about Cicero, I enjoyed it. I hope that maybe you did as well. Thanks for coming.